are listening to AfterSight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Book Review, read by Nora Ami, featuring book reviews authored by critics from the New York Times. Table for Two, Fictions, by Amor Towles. Few literary stylists not named Ann Patchett attained bestsellerdom, but Amor Towles makes the cut. His three lauded novels, Rules of Civility, A Gentleman in Moscow, and The Lincoln Highway, hung around on lists for months, if not years. But Towles' commercial brio belies the care and craft he lavishes on each piece, evidenced now in Table for Two, a knockout collection of six stories and a longish novella. The book spans the 20th century, bringing characters from a range of backgrounds into tableaus of deceit and desire. Beneath his coiffed prose, Towles is a master of the shiv, the bait and switch. We see the flash of light before the shockwave strikes, often in the final sentence. Table for Two is a tale of two cities, New York and Los Angeles, cultural capitals on opposite ends of the continent, but forever tracking the other's trends and deals, a mutual voyeurism. Towles devotes the first section to New York, its wealthy and famous shuffling against strivers and innocents in LaGuardia terminals, musty bookstores, or immigrant communities. The Bootlegger depicts a woman's epiphany after a Carnegie Hall concert. In The Line, a naive communist builds a lucrative business that steers him to Manhattan, where con games lurk on every corner. In The Ballad of Timothy Touche, an allegory of 1990s excess, a rare book stealer with the Dickensian name of Pennybrook manipulates the sympathies of his young assistant, who forges autographs of eminent authors until he's busted by one. Hasta Luego tells the unnerving story of an alcoholic snowbound in a midtown bar on the cusp of the millennium. Towles can't resist mentions of Motorola and Nokia flip phones, reminding us how far away the near past really is. But the Oscar goes to Eve in Hollywood, a novella that unfolds during the filming of Gone with the Wind. Towles tricks out the Tinseltown lore in an homage to the heyday of studio moguls and the hard-boiled fiction of Dashiell Hammett and Raymond Chandler, even alluding to actual legends like Errol Flynn's use of two-way mirrors and peepholes. Towles plucks a character from Rules of Civility, Evelyn Ross, who'd vanished on a Chicago-bound train, picking up her narrative as she's traveling to California. In the dining car, she meets Charlie, a retired LAPD officer who will later prove an asset. She checks into a Beverly Hills hotel, where she befriends an eclectic crew, a portly has-been actor, a chauffeur with stuntman aspirations, and the rising star Olivia de Havilland. Lithe and blonde, sporting an upper-class air and a distinctive facial scar, Eve is fearless, equally at home, among poolside cabanas and seedy clubs where the music's loud and the booze flows. From across the room you could see that no one had a leash on her, one petty crook observes. With the narrowed eyes of a killer, she was sussing out the place, and she liked what she saw. She liked the band, the tempo, the tequila, the whole shebang. If De Havi was bandying about with the likes of this one, you wouldn't have long to wait for the wrong place and the wrong time to have their tearful reunion. When nude photos of De Havilland go missing, part of a larger tabloid plot, Eve vows to save her friend's reputation. She's a femme fatale turned inside out, matching wits amid an array of villains, including a former cop with a double cross up his sleeve. Towles is clearly enjoying himself, nodding to noir classics such as The Postman Always Rings Twice, Chinatown, and L.A. Confidential. The period details are nearly airtight, although I did notice tiny anachronisms about Elizabeth Taylor and the slang term easy peasy. Table for Two delivers the kick of a martini served in the Polo Lounge. The cover art is a cropped image of a couple at a bar dressed in black tie. But there's more here than high gloss. Both coasts are ideal settings for morality plays about power, as Tolles cunningly weaves in themes of exploitation, an allusion to Shelley's Ozymandias, a bust of Julius Caesar glimpsed by Eve on the Ides of March. Whether we're living in the era of late-stage capitalism is beside the point. Money, Tolles suggests, will simply mutate into another form, preying on the vulnerable. When it moves quickly without a sound, a second thought, or the slightest hint of consequence, he writes. Like the wind that spins a windmill, money comes out of nowhere, sets the machinery in motion, then disappears without a trace. It's on us to summon our better angels. Sharp-edged satire, deceptively wrapped like a box of Newhouse chocolates, Table for Two is a winner. This review was written by Hamilton Kane, who is a book critic and the author of This Boy's Faith, Notes from a Southern Baptist Upbringing. Clear by Caris Davies. Caris Davies' work is often interested in imagining the worldview of characters whose cultures and languages are destroyed by colonialism. It's a daring and necessary undertaking. When language itself is extinguished and culture allowed to disappear, we cannot mourn except through imagination. Davies' books, which include the novels The Mission House and West, attend to individual characters and brief events, but the stakes are high. In her new novel, Clear, the lost language is Norn, spoken on the Shetland Islands for several centuries. The islands were subject to the clearances in the 19th century, when landlords violently evicted whole communities from Scottish land. Davies' imagined Norn speaker is Ivar, the last person left of a small island community after his father and brothers died at sea and his mother, sister, and neighbors died or departed for better lives on more populated isles. Before their numbers diminished, the islanders paid rent to their landlord by bartering hand-knitting, feathers, seaweed, and farm labor, tending to the island's livestock. But now that Ivar is alone, he can't pay. For years, the collection agent has not visited, but the novel opens with the end of this era. The wealthy family that owns the island has decided that the land must be cleared, and so their agent employs a penurious pastor, John Ferguson, to travel to the land and evict Ivar. John is ambivalent about the job, though relieved to be earning a good sum for the assignment. Like so many foot soldiers of empire, he can see the ethical problems of his task, but he needs the money. He has left the established church over a matter of principle and needs to finance a breakaway group. And he has also recently married Mary, a lively and curious woman whom he wants to support. Mary approves of his religious calling, but is dubious about his money-making mission. John arrives on the island and, exploring on his first morning there, falls off a cliff. The story is simple after that. Ivar finds and cares for John. As John heals, he and Ivar become close. John postpones the brutal act that is his purpose on the island, and then Mary comes in search of her missing husband. But the storytelling is sophisticated and playful, swooping back across decades to Mary's childhood and John's vocation, and among different points of view. We leap between John's and Ivar's voices on the island, to Mary now and in the past, and, at the moment of John's accident, into a second-person voice and a glorious, anachronistic aerial view unknown to the 19th-century gaze. If you'd been up in the island above the sky that morning with the gannets, you would have seen his tiny black figure leaving the bally house and making its way across patches of pink thrift and lush green pasture. This is a novel of aftermath, the island's lifeways over and its community gone. It's a Robinson Crusoe in reverse, where, rather than investing imperial capitalism, the man alone on the island thinks outside modern structures of knowledge and power. There's no nostalgia, just playful attention to time and place. Clear is deeply interested in language, and particularly in words for the natural world. John cannot distinguish different fogs and mists for which Ivar has terms. He still couldn't differentiate, for example, between the great number of words that to him seemed to denote a rough sea. Nor could he separate a gob from a goggle, a degi from a dwapple, a dwag from a dayun. John's alienated gaze misses what matters for survival. His theological scholarship doesn't help here. Davies has done her research, and these are real words in a real dead language. Clear contemplates fictional resuscitations, opening itself and its readers to the ghosts of lost ideas through John's dawning understanding and love of Ivar's words. The novel is bold and inevitably not flawless. The ending gestures toward an unconvincing resolution. But if you like wild writing and high-stakes thinking in small, polished form, you'll like this. This review was written by Sarah Moss, whose books include The Fell, Summer Water, and Ghost Wall. Her memoir, My Good Bright Wolf, will be published in October. She lives in Ireland, where she teaches creative writing at University College, Dublin. The Mango Tree, a memoir of fruit, Florida, and felony, by Annabel Tomatich. When her 64-year-old mother was arrested in 2015 for shooting a BB gun at the truck of someone who she believed had stolen fruit from her Florida property's mango tree, one of Annabel Tomatich's colleagues called to check in. Because Tomatich worked at the New Press, a daily newspaper in her hometown, Fort Myers, this colleague had more than her well-being on his mind. "You have to write something, huh?" she asked, pausing to take the call outside the courthouse where her mother, Josefina, had just appeared. But Tomatich knew the answer. A story is a story, and this one had a Floridian ripeness no local reporter could deny. The writer's loyalties, Tomatich also understood, exist in tension with a hunger for story, which is to say, her need for coherence, a means of control. Tomatich's nonfiction debut, The Mango Tree, a memoir of fruit, Florida, and felony, bears out this tension. In reclaiming Josefina from the mugshot and clickbait headlines that followed her arrest, the author opens the door to something even more lasting, and possibly more severe, a daughter's unflinching gaze. For the better part of The Mango Tree, that gaze belongs to Tomatich as a shy, recessive child, a girl whose longing for normality, a consuming wish to belong, is spawned by her eccentric, tumultuous family, but comes to extend well beyond it. In large measure, this wish is a product of Tomatich's biracial identity. Josefina, who left her family in the Philippines to work as a nurse in the United States, married a privileged white American man. Though both sought to escape their families of origin, they were bound to them in opposite ways. Dad lived off his parents most of his life, Tomatich observes. Mom supported hers until the days they died. The early chapters are haunted by the presence of Josefina's mother-in-law, Josephine, a sickly and increasingly horrid woman who refers to Josefina as, among other slurs, that mongoloid. Using the present tense to convey her preteen and adolescent perspectives, Tomatich adopts a tone of tart remove, a mix of knowing and wide-eyed intrigue. This is a narrator who notices that although her mother is strong and capable, while Josephine is frail and weak, Grandma is white, and whiteness entails a greater proximity to power, if not the thing itself. Keeping us close to the child's eye view of her formidable mother and the tragedies that befall their family, including her father's sudden mysterious death when Tomatich was 9, yields moments of unexpected humor and stinging truth. She writes scene and dialogue with the metronomic precision of a seasoned broadsheet reporter, her leads and kickers often bearing a sly, precocious slant. Tito Gary's funeral falls somewhere between Dad's and Grandma's in terms of attendance, she begins one chapter, following her uncle's suicide in their home. To the 10-year-old narrator, this latest death makes even less sense than the others. Why would anyone want to leave America? We've got liberty and justice for all. Later, when Josefina takes her children on their first trip to Manila, Tomatich's initial alienation from her extended family and their poverty seeds to a creeping admiration for her mother, who appears poised and self-assured in her native element, able to shame her siblings into doing her bidding with a mere tilt of her head. Unlike her daughter, Josefina does appear to have a place where she is normal, a home where she belongs. Occasionally, Tomatich will slip out from behind her child's perspective to let us know, for instance, what she believes now about the unresolved circumstances surrounding her father's death. These moments are brief and grow more conspicuous as the story progresses. Few scenes depict Josefina and her adult daughter together. We learn in a stroke that Tomatich didn't see her mother for the 6 months between the shooting, which shattered the rear window of the plaintiff's truck, and Josefina's sentence hearing. Increasingly strange in her habits and behaviors, at one point Tomatich refers to her mother as manic depressive, Josefina remains a staunch but elusive figure, remorseless about the felony charge for which she served 5 years of probation. Tomatich's reclamation of the mother whose jailing she fantasized about as a child hinges on a dawning sense of her own internalized shame. The justice system does not see her as a whole person worthy of leniency and redemption, and up until this point, neither did I, Tomatich writes, late in the book, of the harshness of Josefina's punishment. The reader clamors for a sense of what has proceeded from that reckoning, a story as yet untold. This review was written by Michelle Orange, whose latest book is Pure Flame, A Legacy. Glorious Exploits by Ferdia Lenin. There is a small moving detail in Plutarch's account of the Athenian defeat at Syracuse during the final stages of the Peloponnesian War. In 412 BC, the Athenian forces, then the dominant power in the Aegean, overplayed their hand. Routed in a brutal sea battle, rounded up as prisoners into the quarries of Syracuse and given starvation rations, some Athenians survived, Plutarch writes, because the Syracusans so loved the tragedies of Euripides that they offered food or freedom in exchange for verses. It would be like if the Viet Cong released American POWs for singing Elvis. They say that many Athenians who reached home in safety greeted Euripides with affectionate hearts and told him that they had been set free from slavery for rehearsing what they remembered of his works, Plutarch wrote. This is the seed of Ferdia Lenin's breezy, winning debut, Glorious Exploits, set in ancient Syracuse, but written in the language of contemporary Ireland, where Lenin was raised. There has been a pleasing recent turn away from making ancient people in fiction speak in the style of Victorian poets, including Emily Wilson's sublimely wry, unpretentious Homer translations and Pat Barker's less successful feminist retellings of Athenian tragedy. Lenin's vernacular gives the novel a shambolic charm, a story told in a Dublin bar by a drunk lurching between poetry and obscenity. Your best friend tonight, even if he might not remember you tomorrow. Lampo, the narrator, is an illiterate, unemployed potter with a love of wine. He begins the story on a sunny morning, going to the quarry with his friend Gellin to feed the Athenians, the way someone might idly feed ducks. They smell the captives before seeing them. Ah, and I like the way they smell, thinks Lampo. It's awful, but it's wonderful awful. They smell like victory and more. Every Syracusan feels it when they get that smell. Even the slaves feel it, rich or poor, free or not. You get a whiff of those pits, and your life seems somehow richer than it did before. Your blankets warmer, your food tastier. The Athenians also serve another purpose. A mouthful of olives for some Medea, Gellin shouts as the starving captives crowd around, trying to remember lines. Eventually, the two plot to put on a full production of Medea, with chorus, masks, and shit, along with Euripides' newest tragedy, The Trojan Women, never before seen in Sicily. The middle of the novel is essentially a buddy comedy. They secure the backing of a mysterious funder. Lampo spends their money on booze and clothes. They pick up ruffians, eager to help, and they grow somewhat fond of the Athenians. Lampo periodically ruffles their hair, which floats away in the breeze from malnutrition. This is all fun. I first read the novel in one happy sitting on a plane, but Lenin attempts to go deeper, with mixed success. One sign of ambition is his choice of play. Euripides probably wrote some 90 in his lifetime, and Plutarch doesn't specify which the captives sang for freedom. Medea, one of his most famous, is an obvious choice, but Trojan Women, about Hecuba, Cassandra, and the women left after the sacking of Troy as they wait to be taken into slavery, is something else. Instead of the typical tragic arc from power to ruin, it begins and ends in misery. Trojan Women was likely at least partly inspired by the Athenian army's slaughter of the entire adult male population of Milos the year before it premiered. The men were butchered, the women and children sold, in a tactic summarized as the strong do what they can and the weak suffer what they must. This setup, conquerors made captive, then made to play versions of their own victims before an audience of their recent conquerors, promises an interesting experiment about reversal, sympathy, and power. But instead, the novel seems to assert, rather than show or interrogate its central idea, a vague one about the power of storytelling. A phrase that makes me feel like a dutiful AP English student, or the kind of person who owns an I Love Books mug. In The Iliad, Hecuba says that she wants to cannibalize her son's killer, to eat his liver like a carrion bird on the battlefields of Troy. In Medea, the queen's rage at her unfaithful husband is so great that she slaughters her own children. These are stories about deep, excruciating ties of love and friendship and family, severed again and again by war and death. There's nothing approximating that depth of feeling in Lenin's novel. Relationships feel like those between drinking buddies, affectionate and fun, but bloodless. This review was written by Annalise Quinn. She is an articles editor at the Boston Globe magazine. Murder and Maman by Mia P. Manansala. Murder and Maman is the fourth in Mia P. Manansala's series featuring the Midwestern small-town coffee shop owner and baker Lila Macapagal. Though the effervescent delights of Manansala's opening salvo, arsenic and adobo, are still very much in evidence, now Lila's world feels richer and more fully imagined. Manansala has become truly enmeshed in her characters' lives, and it shows. Lila has helped establish the Bruja Cafe as a staple in Shady Palms, Illinois. Her love life is stable, and she feels more rooted in her community and her family, both biological and chosen. The arrival of her cousin Divina from the Philippines and the opening of a new laundromat by Lila's godmothers, the calendar crew of April, May, and June, point to more good news. But then someone vandalizes the laundromat and murders Divina, leaving a spray-painted message next to her body, "Mind your business." Is this directive referring to the gossipy godmothers who love to stick their noses in everyone's affairs? When the local police fail to make much headway, Lila decides she must unearth whatever secrets proved so deadly for her cousin, even as she's warned, "Be prepared to find out stuff about Divina and maybe even your mom that you'd rather not know." Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Book Review, read by Nora Ami.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.